This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Kelvin Yee. Today, we're talking about the changing idea of ownership. Let's say your friend wants to read one of your books. In the old days, you lent the book to them, then they read it and return it. These days, technology has made that process a little bit more complicated. Let me explain. Say that book you own were an ebook, then lending a book isn't as straightforward anymore. Sure, a lot of services allow you to share some titles, or you could pass your entire e-reader to your friend, but that isn't exactly the same as lending a friend a copy of your book. And if you think about it, there are many things you can't do with your ebook that you can with a physical book, like reselling it, donating it, passing it down in your will. So the question is this: when we buy an e-something, like books, movies, or music, do we really own it? Or do the retailers continue to own it? To answer those questions, I spoke with Aaron Pozanowski, Professor of Law at Case Western Reserve University and the author of the book The End of Ownership. I asked Aaron to walk me through the e-buying process. Now, I'm a huge fan of Harry Potter, so I decided to buy both the physical book and the e-book. The Sorcerer's Stone is $679 on paperback and $645 for the ebook. A slight price difference, but is that also true of the rights attached to those purchases?
So arguably that is the case. That's the way that courts in the United States so far have understood this distinction between digital and tangible objects. So think about what you can do with your hardcover of Harry Potter. You bring it home, you read the book, you get to keep it for as long as you want, you get to lend it to a friend after you've finished. If you want to, you can donate it to your local public library, you can leave it to someone in your will, you can sell it at a used bookstore if you want to, right? That's all the stuff that we assume correctly that we can do with the physical books that we buy. If you try to take those same actions with respect to the ebook version, if you try to resell it, if you try to lend it to someone, if you try to give it away, you're going to run into the terms of the license agreement that the seller of that ebook says govern your use of that product. And those license terms, which of course no rational consumer ever bothers to read. These are agreements that are thousands of words long. Almost no one looks at them. But if you do,
right, we all just click I agree and then we move on.
Exactly, right. We all click I agree or we click the buy now button, whatever the option is on the particular site. But if you bother to read them, if you sit down like I have and you take a look at them, they say very explicitly that you do not have these rights to resell, to lend, to give away, to donate. Even the right to ongoing possession of these ebooks or other digital goods is not as certain as consumers might imagine. So several years ago now, I think in 2009 or 2010, Amazon decided to pull a number of books from its Kindle store. It was in a dispute with copyright holders about who actually had the right to sell these books. And so they said, well, you know, until we resolve this, we're not going to sell these books. And they even went a step further. And for people who had already purchased and downloaded these books, which ironically included George Orwell's book 1984, for people who had already downloaded these books, Amazon remotely deleted them from their Kindles using the software that they control that runs those devices. So you go to bed one night thinking you own a copy of 1984, and you wake up the next morning and your book is gone. You know, that's just sort of unthinkable when it comes to physical books. You know, your local bookseller can't break into your house in the middle of the night and take your books away, even if they leave you a refund for the purchase price. But that's exactly the kind of behavior that can and sometimes does happen in the digital space. So there, I think you get a really clear illustration of the difference between these two means of distribution.
So one of the reasons I'm speaking to you today is because you wrote a book called The End of Ownership. Could you share with listeners the premise of your book?
Sure. So the book is an effort to outline what I think is a really important cultural shift that we're sort of in the midst of right now. So my co-author, Jason Schultz, and I are trying to trace this shift from an economy that really revolves around the exchange of physical goods to an economy that is really premised on the exchange of information. And the most obvious way that we all kind of feel that shift is the move from physical media to digital media, right? So people are buying fewer CDs and DVDs and hardcover books, and they're starting to buy digital books, digital movies, digital music, or to get access to media through subscription streaming services like Netflix or Spotify. That's the obvious piece of the shift. I think what is less obvious to people is the way that the digital world is making its way back into the physical objects that surround us. So, you know, the rise of smart devices and the Internet of Things, where software plays this really crucial role in all sorts of objects that we use in our day-to-day lives. And what we think that means is that the role that ownership plays is starting to change. You know, in this earlier era, we could rely on personal property rights in the things that we buy. And today, our relationship to the objects and the products that we consume is arguably very different. So it's no longer defined just by personal property law, but it starts to be defined by intellectual property law, by contracts and license agreements, and digital rights management technologies and these kinds of software tools that allow for restrictions on how we use the things that we interact with.
Was there a particular moment or experience that you had that made you wonder about ownership?
That's a really good question. It's an issue that has been on my mind in one form or another for a really long time. I would say maybe the first moment that I kind of became aware of this set of questions was before I was a lawyer, before I was even studying the law, when the DVD made its introduction onto the market, there was this system of region coding. So that DVDs that were manufactured for use in North America couldn't be played in Asia, and DVDs that were manufactured for Asia couldn't be played in Europe. And that was an early example of this same kind of restriction on ownership, right? Where they say, sure, you own this DVD, you own this physical object, but we have technology that tells you how and where you can use it. And I remember running into that problem, right? Buying an imported DVD, taking it home, and not being able to watch the film that I thought I owned. That was, I think, one of the first times that this set of issues really struck home with me. And I've been following this really closely throughout my career as a lawyer, and for the last several years now, my career as a legal academic. And once you take note of this set of issues, you start to see it everywhere. You know, not a week goes by that I don't see another example, another story of this kind of slow, gradual encroachment on the personal property rights of consumers.
After this, Aaron explains how you can have reduced rights when it comes to your e-goods. This is the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Become fabulous millionaires. BFM 89.9.
You're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Kelvin Yee. Today, we're talking about the changing idea of ownership, specifically when it comes to e-things like books, movies, and music. For example, do we actually own the music we buy from the Apple Store? If you wanted to, could we resell it or give our songs away? I'm speaking with Aaron Pozanowski, Professor of Law at Case Western Reserve University, to learn more. Aaron takes us through a real-world example where a company seemed to own something even after it had been bought.
one of the most striking examples over the last few months involved a home automation hub, a device called the Revolve. Revolve was put out by Nest. Nest is a company owned by Google. So Nest acquired the original manufacturer of the Revolve device. And this is a $300 or so device that you put in your home that controls all sorts of devices in your home. So it can adjust your lights. It can control your home security system. It can control your window coverings and your home entertainment system. And lots of people had purchased this device, and they received word from Google and Nest that the device was no longer going to be supported. And not only would the software not be updated, but Nest proactively sent out a software update that effectively killed this device, that rendered it inert, right? That bricked it. It didn't serve its function any longer. That, I think, is a really chilling example of the kind of power that software can provide a manufacturer over a device that's inside your home and presumably under your own control. If they can do that with your home automation hub, what's to say that they can't do that with your smart refrigerator or your smart car, for that matter? That case ultimately resulted in Nest providing a full refund to every single purchaser of that device, but only after the U.S. Federal Trade Commission intervened and I think sent a pretty strong signal to Nest that they saw this as essentially an abuse of the trust of their consumers, that this was an unfair trade practice. So there is some legal limit on the extent to which companies can undermine consumer expectations in their property rights. But we can't rely on regulators to step in every time this happens. This was a very high profile and incredibly egregious example. Most of the examples are not quite so obvious or so easily resolved.
Just going back to the earlier thing you were talking about, which were the terms of agreements, you know, I guess the common argument is if you want to use it, you got to agree to it. You know, if you don't agree to the terms and conditions, you can't use an app or, you know, something like Facebook, for example. Is that fair to us?
So what I would say is, you know, oftentimes, in the vast majority of cases, actually, consumers do not engage with these license terms. They don't read them. If they do read them, they don't understand them. There have been lots of studies conducted that show that very few consumers, you know, fewer than 1% of consumers even click on the link that takes them to these terms, and far fewer read and understand the language there. And I don't know if it is appropriate to hold consumers responsible for language that is not, conspicuously noted, you know, language that they have to engage in some degree of investigation just to find in the first place. And I think that's especially true when that fine print stands in such contrast to the language that's used to market and advertise these kinds of products, right? So if you go to Apple or Amazon's site for digital music or ebooks or similar kinds of products, what you will find are bright, shiny buttons that say things like "buy now" or advertisements that say things like "own it in HD." Right? Those words "buy" and "own," I think, have real meaning for consumers. And it's meaning that's actually drawn from the world of physical goods. And in some ways, I think they're relying on those consumer expectations to counteract the effect of the license agreement. On the one hand, the license says, no, you don't own this. You can't lend it. You can't resell it. You can't give it away. But at the same time, they're advertising it using this language that suggests you would treat it in the same way you would treat any other physical good that that you bought. So a colleague, Chris Hufnagel, and I were really interested in this question. So we conducted this survey of almost 1,300 online shoppers to find out what they thought this language meant. What did buy now actually mean to people? And it turns out that a lot of people do believe that they get the same kinds of rights to lend, to resell, to give away, to leave things in their will, to keep things indefinitely with digital goods that they have come to expect in the world of physical goods. And we think that's really important. We think it establishes that some of the advertising language in the digital marketplace is actually deceptive, that it's making a promise to consumers or the suggestion to consumers that they get real ownership rights when in fact they don't. That is the same kind of behavior that the FTC went after in the Revolve case that I mentioned a few minutes ago. Maybe not quite as obviously, maybe not on quite the same scale, but it is an instance where consumers, I think, are being mistreated by the providers of these services.
I can imagine it being quite exhausting as well, because just take software, for example. I could click yes to the terms and read the terms by Apple and then go on Spotify and then having to read another set of terms, which might not be similar at all. And I have to reread the whole thing again to agree to it if I want to.
That's quite right. It's difficult to imagine the average consumer having time to read and understand every agreement they encounter online. And it's not just the retail agreements that we're thinking about here. Almost every large commercial website that you visit has some sort of terms and conditions document or a license agreement document that we would theoretically expect consumers to read and process. And frankly, these agreements are not written for the average human to read them and understand them. They're written for lawyers to understand. If you look at the educational background that's necessary to process the information conveyed in these agreements, they're written on a level that requires a, you know, postgraduate education. They're not the sort of thing that we should expect the average person to understand. In addition to that, in addition to the fact that we have to worry about a multitude of sites, all of which have their own slightly different variation on these terms, these terms change even on a given site. You know, Amazon's terms today are not the same as they were 6 months ago. Apple's terms today are not the same as they were 6 months ago or 3 months ago or maybe even 1 month ago. They change, and in sometimes important respects. So then we have this sort of ongoing obligation on the part of consumers to not just read the terms once, but to diligently check them for updates and read them again and try to remember, is this the same as it was last time? And, you know, that is an obligation that I don't think is fair to put on consumers when we're talking about purchases of, you know, $9.99 for a movie or 99 cents for a song. Economically, it would be irrational to read these thousands of words long agreements to make those kinds of purchasing decisions.
After this, I talked to Aaron to see if our relationship with things that were once only tangible, things you could touch like books, music albums, movie DVDs, if that relationship to those items have changed now that we can own them in untouchable forms, MP3s, ebooks, PDFs. You're listening to The Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Audacious, fabulous minds. BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to The Evening Edition. I'm Kelvin Yee. Today, I'm speaking to Aaron Pazanowski from the Case Western Reserve University to answer the question of whether we own what we buy. E-goods like music, books and movies, but also things like smart devices as they become more and more ingrained in our daily lives. From my conversation with Aaron so far, it seems that we presently have very different rights for physical goods and non-physical goods. But is that necessarily a bad thing when now it's just so much more convenient and so much cheaper to get the music and movies that we want? Instead of spending 50 ringgit on a single album, I could just get a Spotify subscription for much cheaper and have access to their entire library. Is trading off rights in place of convenience worth it? Is it necessarily a bad thing?
So I think that's a really important point. And I think sometimes people misunderstand the argument that we're trying to make to say that digital distribution is bad, that it's harmful, that we should reject it. And I don't think that's actually true at all. I think you're absolutely right that the price for access for many consumers has gone down. It's a lot cheaper to watch thousands of movies on Netflix than it is to go out and buy all of those same thousands of movies on DVD or Blu-ray. The same is absolutely true for Spotify. So I think it's great. It's wonderful that we have this new option for people who want to buy or rather want to pay for temporary access through subscription services. And I haven't done this work. I haven't done a survey to find out whether Netflix and Spotify subscribers understand that when they stop paying their monthly bill, they no longer have access to this content. But I'm really confident that consumers understand that. They know the difference between subscribing to a service and buying something that they own on a sort of permanent ongoing basis. So I'm not worried too much about the Spotify's and the Netflix's of the world, because I think they're very clear in what their business model is and the relationship that consumers have to the content that they are accessing. I'm much more worried about business models like the digital download model for ebooks, for music, for movies that you see from, you know, Apple and Amazon, that I think are fundamentally premised on deception of some significant percentage of consumers, that are premised on the promise of ownership and the reality of conditional access, right? So I think it's important to draw a distinction between those two very different means of digital distribution.
Just stepping away from the legalities a bit, you know, do you think it's changed our relationship to books, you know, to things that were once tangible and now intangible?
That's a really tough question to answer. I think it's a really interesting and really important question. And I think the answer varies in important ways from person to person. I talk to people who express a really strong preference for physical media, who say, you know, my enjoyment of a book is greater when I'm holding a hard copy in my hands, when I can smell it, when I can hear the pages turn, where I can feel the texture of the page underneath my finger. And I talk to other people, my students often, for example, are perfectly content to read an ebook, and they don't see that experience as inferior. So I think it varies. And that's one of the reasons that I think it's so important that we maintain a marketplace where people have choices, where the people who want to subscribe get to subscribe, and the people who want to own get to own, and the people who want digital can acquire digital goods, and the people who want physical goods can do the same. Because I think it's really hard to generalize about that experience.
And, you know, the digital age has brought on this thing where we're very familiar with, you know, that downloading stuff for free is a completely new culture. You know, we download images, we download music, and it's just odd because sometimes it feels like when we do download it, it feels like it's ours, even though we've done it illegally. Why do you think there's this sense that when I can click a link on a computer that allows me to obtain, that I have this false sense that I own this product or material? Do you think it's something that you see happening?
I do think there is a generational distinction in terms of how people think about the acquisition of media. For people of a certain generation, the way that you acquired media was to go to a bookstore, go to a record store, and buy something physical. And then there was a period where digital authorized, lawful digital downloads were, you know, really the prevailing means of acquiring music. But we also have this sort of generational divide between people who are accustomed to paying for things and people who are not. And I think if you operate in that space where unauthorized downloads, infringing downloads have been sort of normalized, you might not draw a distinction in terms of ownership between things you paid for and things you didn't. Things that live on your hard drive or on your devices somehow feel like they are yours, in some sense, regardless of the legal claim that you might have to them. I actually think that's problematic. Copyright law, in a lot of ways, I think has become excessive. It has interfered in the daily lives of the average consumer more than it should. But I don't think it's unreasonable to expect consumers to pay for the things that they want to listen to or watch or read. One of the really good things that we can say about services like Netflix and Spotify is that they have lowered the price point for participation in lawful copyright markets. Maybe you can't afford to buy every movie that you want to watch at, you know, at the price of a Blu-ray disc or a digital download. But more people can afford to pay the monthly subscription rate for a service like Netflix. So I think that's a really positive development that we shouldn't lose sight of. The other thing that I think is worth pointing out, though, is if we expect people, as we should, to pay for the content that they enjoy, we have to make sure that is a reasonable value proposition for them. So if we tell people, hey, we want you to spend $9.99 to download this digital album, we should make sure that that $9.99 comes with a set of rights that are valuable to consumers, that are reliable, that they can count on in the long run. So the more often consumers hear about situations where, you know, content is remotely deleted or there are restrictions placed on people when they move from one country to another, or they can only use the content they purchase on one company's device and not other companies' devices or, you know, mobile phones. That makes it harder, I think, to convince people to pay a fair price for their access to that material. So I think we've got to make sure that we're giving consumers compelling reasons to pay, and part of that means giving them the kinds of property rights that they expect to have, the right to borrow or lend, the right to give things away. So I think that's a crucial piece of this conversation about copyright infringement.
Today, I'm speaking with Aaron Pozanowski, law professor from Case Western Reserve University. After this, we find out if legal systems are at all catching up. You're listening to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Bruce Freddy Morrissey, BFM 89.9.
You're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Kelvin Yee. Today, I'm speaking to Aaron Pozanowski from the Case Western Reserve University to answer the question of whether we own what we buy, specifically e-goods like music, books, and movies. We've covered plenty so far, but there's one element of the transaction that we've yet to touch upon, the legal system. So it seems like we have reduced rights. We don't really own all our e-somethings, from examples of Amazon suddenly deleting books from Kindles, to Google Nest making Revolve, the smart home device, useless by disabling the hardware and software. What can the courts do to help consumers? Are they even catching up?
So the legal systems around the world that are confronting this issue, I think, are struggling mightily to make sense of what's going on here. So in the United States, so far, there's really only been one case that has tested this issue. It's a case brought by Capitol Records, one of the major record companies here, against a technology startup called Redigi. And what Redigi tried to do was make an online digital marketplace for used digital music. So they would allow you as a consumer to essentially sell your Apple iTunes music files that you have purchased to another user. And they had sophisticated technology that was designed to make sure that the seller of that used music didn't keep a copy after it was transferred to the buyer of that used digital music. And that case is still ongoing. It's on appeal right now. And, you know, I think it is less than clear how that case will be resolved when it's finally decided. Courts are struggling to make sense of the application of these kind of traditional principles of personal property when it comes to the internet. Do we think of that transfer the same way as we think of me selling you a used CD, or do we think of it more like someone making unauthorized copies of a work and sharing them with total strangers? That is an easy case of infringement. So which is the closer analogy? The law's a little bit more developed, although still in flux in Europe, where we have a case that permitted the resale of software licenses. So in the software space, we have some confidence that these kinds of used markets or secondary markets are permissible. And there's been some extension of that same rationale to ebooks in a case called Tom Cabinet, but also fairly early in the process and hard to predict exactly how this will play out in the future. I don't think it's a question that copyright law can avoid because this is the reality today, and it is the future that we're going to continue to see digital distribution play a really big role in markets for these kinds of products. So we have to decide one way or the other whether or not consumers get to continue to have ownership whether they get to continue to enjoy personal property rights, or instead we're going to live in a future where every use that you make is determined on the basis of the permission of the company who sold the product to you.
Aside from involving the courts all the time, what can we as consumers do?
There are a couple of ways that I think consumers can influence this debate. To the extent it's an issue that lots of people care about, legislation is a possibility. There have been bills introduced in the U.S. Congress to address some of these issues. They have not been successful so far, and in part they haven't been successful because this is not an issue that has motivated a sufficient number of members of the public. Whether that will happen in the future, I think, is a hard question to answer. Getting legislatures, national legislatures, to act in a space like this against the interests of really large, sophisticated copyright holders who have powerful lobbying groups, I think, is a big challenge. The smaller scale thing that consumers can do, and they've had some success in doing, is directly putting pressure on the companies that make and sell these kinds of products. So an example here, there's a company called Keurig that makes these pod-based home coffee systems, right? So it's a sophisticated coffee maker that you put these pre-portioned pods of coffee into the machine and press a single button and it spits out what I assume is a reasonably good cup of coffee. I haven't tried it myself. So Keurig is in the business of selling these coffee makers, but they're also in the business of selling the coffee pods themselves, right? So there's a kind of durable goods component, the coffee maker, and then there are the supplies that go into this product. And that's really where the money is. You buy the coffee maker once, but you buy the coffee pods every week when you go to the grocery store. So they introduce technology, a sort of digital rights management for coffee, that involved the machine scanning the lid of these pods, looking for a little code, a code that was printed only by authorized manufacturers. And if that little code wasn't there, the machine on its on-screen display popped up with a little message that said, "Oops, this doesn't appear to be an authorized coffee pod. Go back to the grocery store and buy our coffee instead," right? So your coffee maker is refusing to make your coffee because you haven't paid the right company for that purchase. When that happened, consumers rebelled. There was a real backlash against Keurig when this happened, significant enough of a backlash that their stock value dropped significantly in the quarter that this happened. And I think that sent a really strong signal, not just to Keurig, but to other kinds of companies who are engaged in this kind of behavior, that they have to be careful because there is a point where you push consumers too far. When their, when their home printers stop working because you didn't buy the right brand of ink, when their coffee makers stop working because you didn't buy the right brand of coffee, that may be a signal that consumers actually have more power here than we would initially expect. And so I'm hopeful that in these most egregious kinds of cases, at least, there will be some marketplace discipline for this kind of behavior.
Aaron, before I let you go, I think just one final question, which is, do we own what we buy still?
I think we live in a time where that question, whether we own the things that we buy, is really up for grabs. It's up for debate. It is an ongoing, contentious question. And it's one that we all have an opportunity to weigh in on. And you can weigh in a couple of ways. On the one hand, we all have to decide what it means to own something. In the past, ownership has meant a fairly stable and fairly specific set of rights, at least when it comes to consumer goods, when it comes to personal property. And in some ways, I see the question as asking whether or not ownership is going to continue to mean the same thing in the future, or if we're going to accept a kind of watered down version of ownership in the future. The other way that we can influence the answer to that question, I think, is what I was just talking about a moment ago, exerting some influence in the marketplace and making sellers accountable. So we have a say, I think, in whether we own things in the future or not.
That was Aaron Pozanowski, professor of law at Case Western Reserve University and the author of The End of Ownership, which is available on Amazon, by the way. If you missed any part of this show, you can download the podcast from bfm.my. You've been listening to The Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.